Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Ye.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here this episode for another great author chat. We are talking to author June C.L. Tan about her debut novel, Jade Fire Gold, which is an Asian-inspired fantasy. Rira, what did you think about the book?
I loved reading it. Even though it's a chonky book, I read through it pretty quickly. I know that this was definitely your jam, Marvin, because it had a lot of wuxia influences and you really love Asian-inspired fantasies. So out of all of the ones that we have read so far, how does it compare?
You know, all of the books that we've read have been pretty awesome. I think this is the most action-adventure-y ones that we've read so far. It's very heavy on the adventure, which I love, you know, because that's the cornerstone of any wuxia and xinxia story. And the characters are great, and the world building is amazing. And you know, from my interview with June, she is a world building lover, and it really shows in her prose. And you know, we had a really great chat with June about her background, about her experience shopping this book, and just about all the great stuff that she has in this book as well that we also love. So yeah, without further ado, here is our interview with June C.L. Tan. And we are here with author June C.L. Tan, the author of Jade Fire Gold, which just released at bookstores everywhere. Welcome to the show, June.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you guys.
Yeah. No, I'm super excited to have another Asian-inspired fantasy to recommend to other people because I just can't get enough.
Yeah. I managed to catch a little bit of your book launch with Book of Wonder with Joan He. I was actually doing another author event, so I like wasn't supposed to watch, but I was like, I have to catch some of it. And I found out that you were a BTS fan, so that made my heart really happy.
Are you an ARMY too? Like,
yes, I am wearing my butter cardigan, and
I have
my BT21 coffee mug.
I have like my stuff too, but they're like further away.
It's okay. It's a podcast. No one will be able to see it.
True.
Describe it for me, Rira. What does it look like?
I mean, my coffee mug is pretty much pink with a lot of cute animal
Those are their line characters, right?
Like, yeah, it's the line characters. Yes, for those of you who use line, you should know, because those are your default emoticon/emojis.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure like people know what BT21 is. Oh, they have seen like some of the characters.
By this point, you probably know what it is.
I mean, if even I know, you know, you can't escape it.
That's true. But you also have been my co-host for 5 years. So for a huge chunk of those years, I've been a BTS fan. So you've just kind of had to deal with all of my fangirlness. So
Are you going to the concert?
Yes, I'm going on Sunday and I'm going on Thursday, and I am hoping I get to go on the first day. So we shall see.
I am so jealous. If I was in California still, I would definitely go. But unfortunately, I don't think I can make it this time. I'm very, very sad.
It's okay. There's streaming exists.
Yes.
So I'm going to watch that. Yes. But this is not a BTS podcast.
BTS and Bulba.
Okay.
The thing is, if you are an author and you're a BTS fan, we'll get along swimmingly in future episodes, just so you know.
We always like to start off our author interviews by learning more about your background as an author. Was writing something you've always done growing up? Was it something that you picked up? And, you know, how you became a novelist?
I guess like with many, many writers and authors, I enjoyed reading when I was a child. And I read voraciously. I read during meals, even though my parents didn't like it. Instead of watching a TV, I'll be just reading. I would read cereal boxes just to read. And I would write little stories. Sometimes I guess you could call them like early fan fiction in that sense, because you're trying to like mimic an author's style, an author that you admire, or like, you know, write a story in a world if it's a fantasy book or a sci-fi book. So that's how I started going. But soon, like in college and, you know, working life came in, I didn't really write at all. I mean, if I wrote anything, it was like, you know, essays and term papers and stuff like boring academic stuff. Well, not so boring, but you know what I mean? Like a different style and different tone. And it was only much later, sometime, I want to say maybe 7 years ago, that I thought, okay, maybe I want to start writing again, you know. And I started with poetry, writing little snippets of things like flash fiction and so on. And then after a while, I was like, okay, let's try to write a book. And that's kind of what happened. The first complete book I tried to write was probably horrible. And it's somewhere in some, you know, file that I'm not going to look at forever. And then I had the idea for Jade Fire Gold, and I started working on it from about 2016, 2017 for some time. Yep. And that's kind of like a short answer for how I came to start writing a novel. Yeah.
I mean, did you have a background in creative writing? Like, what did you study in school? And
I'm looking at your bio right now, and it says that you have 3 degrees, and that is quite impressive.
Yes and no, because they're a bit useless. Well, they're not useless. I really enjoyed school, but they're not the most practical. Like my undergraduate degree was in media and communications. So it was like studying media and communications and writing essays about that. And the second degree is like a postgraduate thing where I did a diploma in the teaching of English and English literature. And then I taught for a while. And then the third degree is a master's in cinema studies from NYU. And I thought I was going to be a professor after that, like do my PhD and so on. So in a way, they're not the most practical degrees. But
they definitely geared you for storytelling.
Yes, definitely. I think like I've always enjoyed stories, even though perhaps I leaned towards the visual medium. So, you know, watching things, writing about movies, writing about independent films, things like that. And yeah, I mean, they are related to storytelling, like you said. Yeah.
I also went to NYU. Yes, I went to Tisch for dramatic writing, and my partner, he didn't go to Tisch, but he also went to NYU and he studied cinema studies. So I know that you probably wrote a lot of papers, and you are probably more qualified to do this podcast than both Marvin and myself.
Hey, 5 years of practical experience.
Hey, I've never done a I think this is only the second podcast I've done, so I'm no expert. And yeah, and
you can't dunk on her own podcast on her podcast.
I'm just saying that she has more experience breaking down stories and knowing structure and knowing themes. So if you ever want to start a book club podcast, June, I think you're pretty much set in that level of that area of expertise.
It's interesting you say
maybe.
It's interesting that you say that you're more geared toward the visual medium, because your book is very, very cinematic and very, very visual. I want to ask, like, what drew you to writing a Asian inspired fantasy?
Well, I guess, like, even though I grew up in Singapore and, you know, like, I was surrounded by other Asian people, I saw, like, you know, Asian people on TV and in the movies, but still, like, the bulk of the media came from the UK and the US. So it was still a lot of, like, I guess it's a post-colonial mindset where a lot of people are like, oh, you know, Western films are better or Western media is better. And you watch, like, you know, Chinese films or Hong Kong films and you're like, doesn't look as nice or something like that. And there was a little bit of a prejudice, I think. But personally, when I was growing up, I just loved Hong Kong cinema. Whether it was adaptations of wuxia, which is martial arts novels by Qing Yong and Gu Long, or whether it was your Taiwanese period dramas where everyone cries for 60 episodes, you know, nonstop, or it was, you know, court dramas where there's lots of, like, political intrigue going on, people are backstabbing each other, there's lots of, like, military strategy. Like, I just really, really loved all these kind of shows and movies. So when I started writing again, I think I had Asian characters, but the world was contemporary. And then when I had the idea for Jade Fire Gold, I was like, you know, maybe I should make it a little more martial artsy, a little bit more xianxia, which is immortal heroes, like kind of like the stuff that I grew up with and enjoyed. Because when you write a book, you kind of have to reread it like hundreds of times. So you have to love it. You know, you might not be 100% happy with it, but you have to love what you're writing. So I started doing that. And I guess, like what Marvin said, it's the book is, I don't know if I intended it to be super cinematic. It was just the way I write, because I'm the sort of person that unfortunately or unfortunately loves world building. And if no one edits me or if I don't rein myself in, I would describe like a room for like a whole chapter. I would tell you every single thing in it. So I guess that's how my brain works. Like, I tend to see how a scene is laid out and where the positioning of the characters, how they move, what they're wearing, how they look. And then I try to incorporate that in the way I write. Yeah. So perhaps that's why it comes off a little bit more visual. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that you started writing this book in 2017, which is, I think, before the industry as a whole, at least like Hollywood, were into Asians. So I guess, you know, when you were writing it and when you were, you know, even shopping, like how was that experience? Like, was it a hard sell or were you able to?
I'm just going
to
interrupt here. Sorry, Marvin. Yeah. I remember your book pitch from DV Pit back in like 2017, I think.
Wow.
Yes. Because we've been doing this podcast since 2016 and DV Pit was relatively new at that time. I don't know if it was the first time they were doing it in 2017. Maybe it was the second time.
The second time.
Yeah.
Because I pitched in 2016 too.
Yeah.
The same book, but I had no idea how anything worked. I had like,
oh, don't worry. No one did.
I had a third of the book and I thought I can pitch this. And then I pitched it and I realized, oh, you're supposed to query the whole manuscript. And I was like, oh, okay, I better start writing. And then, yeah, that's what happened in 2017. The manuscript was ready and then I pitched it. And well, you're like, you're not the only person who has told me that they remember
it was very distinct, I remember, because it was like Avatar The Last Airbender meets the Grisha trilogy.
Yeah,
I remember. And I was like, oh, interesting. Like, those are like two very different things. How is she going to combine them? But also, I was like, oh, Avatar The Last Airbender, it's inspired by Asian culture. It's inspired by our own, like, martial arts movies and dramas. I was like, is it really Avatar or is it just, like, Asian Asian dramas?
I think we talked about this with Shira and Jade Zhao, but it's like, sometimes you have to speak in their language because they won't get the references that we make, right?
Yeah, because the thing is, I mean, to be honest, I would not have, like, comped it to Avatar The Last Airbender because I hadn't watched it when I was writing this book. I only watched it sometime in 2017, I think just before DV Pit, because someone was like, hey, you know, a CP who read the book was like, this feels a little ATLA. I'm like, what's ATLA? Isn't it that horrible 2010 movie with all the white people? Like, why are you saying my book? Like, because I had no idea it came from a cartoon. And then I watched it. I was like, hey, this is great, but it was so strange because, you know, I found out that the creators, when Asian people, even though I think the writer's room had, like,
Asians, and they also consulted a martial art expert who was also Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I felt that, that seemed like something that the general person or editor or agent might know instead of me saying, Legend of the Condor Heroes, you know, or like Heavenly Saver, they'll be like, what? You know, so I used ATLA and the Grisha thing was more of like, you know, a main protagonist having this power that could be good or could be bad, you know, and that felt like a proper comp. But going back to what Marvin was asking about whether it was difficult when I was trying to find agent, yes, it was. Because I think in 2017, it was kind of when we were seeing more diverse fantasies and fantasies by authors of color being, I hate to use the word trend, but trend, or at least, you know, people were starting to notice, or people's editors were starting to, you know, buy these books. But also, I think, like, it felt to me, at least, people were unsure as to whether an African-American fantasy would sell, an Asian fantasy would sell, you know, Arabian fantasy would sell. So, like, agents would sign, like, just that one client, or a publisher would buy just that one book, you know, just in case it flops or something like that, you know? So it was a difficult time trying to get an agent because, you know, like, the rejections sometimes felt a little colder because it was things like, I couldn't connect with the main character.
Or
things that implied that it wasn't the version of what they think China was. Or, you know, they were tired of some of the tropes. And I'm like, I mean, there's so many other Lost Air tropes to Lost Air books. What's wrong with this one? So it was difficult. But I think the turning point for me was getting into Pitch Wars and getting a mentor who not only advised me and, you know, helped me, like, you know, polish the book even more so that eventually I did get an agent. Yeah. But then, of course, you know, you have to submit to publishers and that's always a struggle for, you know, marginalized authors. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were able to persevere and pull through because, you know, this book is, it takes a lot of inspirations from things that, you know, as a Chinese diaspora I am familiar with from watching those Hong Kong and Taiwanese period dramas, you know, the Wuxia, the Xinxia, the even the imperial court dramas, right? You know, it was really cool to see that on page and, you know, told in such a way. I really appreciated it.
I feel like you said, I don't want to say trend either, but there's been a surge of Asian-inspired fantasy. And what I've noticed from, like, other interviews with these authors, Asian diasporan authors, they kind of have this hesitation to take creative licenses with Asian folklore and history because it's, you know, they worry that it's not going to be authentic enough or original enough, or are they the right person to adapt something that's not from, like, because they're American. So I just want to ask, like, did you experience this conflict? I know you grew up in Singapore and there's a lot of, like, modern versus traditionalism and intersectionality over there. So I'm just curious.
Yes and no. I think when I first started drafting Jade Fire Gold, I didn't think too hard about whether I could write it or I was in the position or the right person to write something like that, you know, Asian fantasy and so on, or Chinese fantasy, because it was so familiar to me. It was part of my childhood. Like, my friends and I would watch it. We knew, you know, like the tropes, the storylines and all that kind of stuff. So it felt really organic. And it was only a little later when I guess like there was a lot of debate and discussion about own voices and what did own voices mean. And when, unfortunately, the term became a little weaponized against, you know, marginalized creators, that I started like thinking more deeply about, you know, the book and what I was writing and how I would write future books. I think every diaspora author goes through this really painful process of being like, hey, but it is my culture. But when you write it, you're like, who am I representing? Am I just representing myself? Am I representing the whole culture? Or am I representing a small group? And I think like it's something I still think about, and I think like all marginalized creators think about, but it's something I also decided for myself that yes, I do have a voice. I do have the right to write it because it's my experiences. It comes from my family. It comes from my ancestors. And we always say that culture is not a monolith, you know, diaspora is not a monolith. And I think especially for Asian diaspora, whether it's South Asian, East Asian, or Southeast Asian, or just Chinese diaspora, it is so complex because you have literally thousands of years of history and thousands of years of migration patterns. And what your ancestors bring from a region of a really large country is completely different sometimes to what, you know, generations before or generations later will bring. Let me give you an example. Like, I happen to be very familiar with folklore and legends like the moon goddess, like the cowherd and weaving maiden, you know, the Chinese Romeo and Juliet butterfly lovers and things like that, because those are stories I grew up with. When I came to America and I met some Chinese Americans, and their families had left China later than my family did, you know, my ancestors did, and they didn't bring those stories with them. You know, sometimes like when a generation migrates, they leave part of their culture behind depending on the situation in terms of how they moved. So the community that grows in a different country, you know, it's still going to be diaspora. It's still going to be Chinese, but it's just, you know, with tweaks, it evolves a little bit. So I think it's actually very unfair to tell people who want to create based on their own personal experiences that no, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to say this, you shouldn't be allowed to write this story, you know, as long as it's done with respect and as long as, you know, they thought carefully about what they're writing and done their research and so on. Yeah, but it is a struggle. yeah
I love how you say diaspora isn't a monolith, because I feel like a lot of people forget that. I know that for a lot of readers out there, maybe it'll be the first time they see themselves remotely represented. And when they're not represented like 100%, it could be painful because they don't have any other examples. And this is why representation matters so much. And because diaspora is not a monolith, it's always nice to see so many different types of Asian-inspired fantasy. I mean, like, we just interviewed Sharon J. Zhao, who is the author of Iron Widow, and that is a very different type of Asian-inspired fantasy from Jade Fire Gold. So it is really nice to see that diversity within that community.
Definitely. Like, I think, like, it's definitely true that because there are so few books that represent so few parts of a culture, in America at least, and in US publishing at least, that when readers pick up a book, sometimes they have certain expectations, and when it's not met, they do feel disappointed, and rightly so. But I think the focus should be on the industry. You know, the industry should be buying, you know, various types of books, you know, not just one Chinese fantasy, one Japanese fantasy, one Korean, because that's not how it works, you know? So, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, look at how many wuxia films there are, you know?
Precisely. It's just,
like, there's so many. I'm pretty sure they can buy, like, more than five books that delve into that genre.
definitely. If we can have, like, 101 white princess books in 2 years, we can have 10, you know, non-white princess fantasies. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about Jade Fire Guild, and especially I want to talk, you mentioned that you are a world building fanatic, and you can definitely tell, like, this is a original world. There's some inspirations from, you know, Imperial China and like the Wuxia and Xinxia genre, but you have so many moving pieces. You have like the Imperial capital, you have like the borderlands where, you know, the martial arts sects operate, and just so much history too within this book. Like, how long did it take you to come up with everything? I mean, did you do it as you wrote, or did you have like a whole world bible to operate from before you even got started writing the story?
Okay, strangely speaking, for a world building lover, I didn't have a world bible. I had bullet points and so on, and I thought about writing a world bible, but I think like that bible would be longer than the book. A lot of stuff I researched as I went along the first draft, and then I added on as, you know, I revised and polished a manuscript. And yeah, I think I was also really lucky in the sense that I've been to certain places in China. I have seen those buildings that, you know, and I've also watched, you know, all the movies and shows. So I kind of like knew how the architecture would look like, how the colors would look like. And then when I went to China on holiday a couple of times, they have like preserved villages and obviously the Forbidden Palace and so on. So I just took it in with my eyeballs. But also I didn't, because it's a secondary world fantasy and it's inspired, I didn't want to like, you know, make it too obvious that I was talking about this specific place in China or this specific place in some other city or country. And a lot of it was kind of like mushing together certain concepts and ideas that I had, like you mentioned, the borderlands, and I guess also like because there's a theme of colonization in the book, so that I kind of took from my knowledge of the British colonization of Southeast Asia, the British East Indies, and so on, and the role that Singapore played in that. And how it was handed from, you know, it was a fishing village and it went into, you know, the British hands, and then it went to the Japanese hands, and then it went back to the British hands, and then it fought for independence. So things like that were running through my mind while I was building the world. So I would say that I took from basically just personal knowledge of, you know, how history has been in our world. Yeah.
I'm always impressed when fantasy authors come up with the magic system. Like with your world, you know, there's like there are priests and there's like religion. And I'm curious, like, how you came up with all of the rules for magic.
I think the fundamental rule for magic, so to speak, is very steeped in Chinese martial arts. The idea of qi. Basically, you know, the flow in your body, circulation, and how it affects, you know, your meridian points. I mean, you find it in traditional Chinese medicine, you find it in acupuncture, find it in Chinese martial arts, and also like I'm not sure whether you call it the slower martial arts, but things like Tai Chi, you know, which is basically like, you know, moving the qi in your body and expelling things and bringing things in. Basically a movement of energy. That's how I understood from research and, you know, from, you know, my grandparents used to like do Tai Chi. So I'll be like, that's my understanding of it. So I had like a pretty, I guess, strong foundation in terms of like, you know, how to come up with, you know, some parts of the magic system. And I will confess that some of it is just aesthetic because like in my head, it's like, okay, if, I guess that's why the ATLA comp works too, because, you know, when you're moving chi around, you're able to move objects. So it's like, you know, wind moving an object, or just the pressure from your, you know, your internal energy moving an object and stuff like that. Or, you know, like heating up your chi so that you could expel fire and so on. So it's just basically a lot of it has to do with, like, you know, assuming that a person is born with an amount of energy and how you're going to manipulate that in that sense. Yeah.
I respect the priority for aesthetics. That is very important. We'll get to aesthetics later on in this talk. Mm-hmm. So your book is told from two alternating POVs, On and Altan. Was that always planned? And how did their voices come to you?
It wasn't always planned that way. Like, it started with An only, like just one protagonist, and going on with her adventures and so on. And but I always knew that she would meet the other character, Altan. And because of how his character is like, he's not likely to say what his emotions are, how he's feeling. And so much of it, of his backstory, is like from his childhood, is all internalized. He's like clogged up with emotions. and he's not gonna like say it out loud. So it felt that he needed a POV so that the reader could see where he's coming from and, you know, like follow his character trajectory and his arc and so on. So I added another POV. And I don't know, I guess like as I was drafting it and writing the book, sometimes I would have this voice in my head and it's him saying things, and I'm like, I guess maybe I need to put you on page more and, you know, give you a voice, so to speak. And I think like at the end of when I finished the book, when I polished it, I felt like it wouldn't have made as much sense, or I wouldn't be able to tell the story I wanted to tell if it was just a single POV. Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely the book really benefited from having Altan's POV. He seems to have like a very dry sense of humor that I definitely relate to. And I don't know, just I love grumpy characters. they're some of my favorite in fiction.
Rira, how was the romance aspect for you?
How was the romance aspect? I love slow burns, and I know romance isn't the main genre of your book, but I think you wrote the slow burn really well. Especially there's like not a lot of touching. It's just a lot of, you know, a lot of deep gazes, and because it's alternating POVs, you hear their inner thoughts like, ooh, mm-hmm. I think she's cute, but I'm not going to say it because I might have to kill her. So, what is your secret to writing good slow burn?
I don't know. And I feel like not everyone's going to agree with you that the romance worked, but I'm very glad that you enjoyed it.
Well, my opinion matters most. So
our official stance as Books and Boba.
Great. I think the romance, because how I saw the story, it was an epic fantasy that had some romance, not a romance fantasy, if that makes sense, or fantasy romance. So the romance wasn't like the main part. You know, because I wanted them sort of opposed to each other, but yet making some sort of emotional connection along the way. So it felt like I needed some romance. And in terms of how to write a slow bit, well, I took my cue from Chinese period dramas because they're so conservative.
Oh, yeah. They're like the masters of slow burn. Yeah. They have like over 100 episodes.
Right? Yeah. Right? And not just Chinese, like, some Korean dramas too, Taiwanese dramas, just Asian dramas, like, you know, because touching is not a thing and making out in a drama is not a thing. Maybe, you know, it fades to black even before they can touch or something like that, you know, or like nothing physical really happens. And you're right, Rira, like it goes for hundreds of episodes and they just drag it on and on and on, you know, but all the while, you know, that, you know, they're attracted to each other. They may be in love with each other, and it's all like communicated with like a wrist grab and then you let go really fast, or like a glance, or like every time I think it was harder to write it because like in a visual media, you know, you're sort of like dependent on, or you have the actors to help you, you know, like if the guy is just, you know, glancing at the girl and his facial expression changes, you know, oh, he's attracted or something like that, the other way around. But in a book, you know, if you're writing from the POV from one character, it's a little hard to say, like, you know, my facial expression changes, you know, it relies a lot on the reader to use that imagination, I think, in that sense, like, you know, when a character is thinking about another character or like focusing a little bit on the character's hair, for example, or how they're looking, for example, or just what they're saying, or maybe thinking a little bit too much about that character, it sort of implies the attraction. Yeah.
I think it also helps when you have side characters who are just like, don't lie to yourself. You like this person. And speaking of those characters, Tang Wei was probably my favorite character in this book. She is such chaos in the best way possible. But I really loved her romance with Lin Shi. I thought they were such an adorable sapphic couple. Mm-hmm. More sapphic couples and Asian inspired fantasies, please, if you're an Asian inspired fantasy writer. I love how the queerness is, you know, it's not a problem. It's really normalized in your world, and there really isn't a fear of retaliation to it. So what made you make that narrative decision, and what are your thoughts in general on like the intersectionality of like POC characters, especially like Asian characters and like the queer community?
Well, I think it comes back to, once again, like when I started thinking about the story and revising it, it just felt like since I was in charge of the world, there was really no need for me to make certain characters of marginalized identities suffer more, because the book is not about that. You know, I think it's different if you're writing something that maybe is about coming out, maybe the struggles of a queer character, but in the book, once again, I focused on different themes, less of identity and a personal identity, and more about, you know, more, how do you say, like, you know, war, conflict, grief, things like that. And it just felt natural for them to live in a world that was queer norm. I think one early reader of the book called it queer norm. I hope I'm quoting her right. Because there's really no need for them to be persecuted, because the people who are being persecuted have magic. And, you know, this, I didn't feel a need to add that second layer in this particular book. And also because, like, in all the martial arts stories that I remember, like, queer characters weren't really a thing. Sometimes it seemed like some characters were coded in a way, be it queer or non-binary, but it was never really explicit. And personally, I wanted it to be explicit in my book. Like, yeah, you know, they're a sapphic couple and they're happy. I didn't want them to be sad. You know, we have other sad couples. Let them have a happy...
Let them stay alive. Don't fridge them.
Yes, let them stay alive. Let them be happy. And that's why I stuck to that and made sure that that was how I wrote, you know, that particular couple. And so you had a second part of the question.
Second part of the question is like, what are your thoughts in general on like the intersectionality of POC characters, especially Asian characters and like the queer community? Because I don't know if our listeners know, but queer Asians existed in history. So I don't see why they can't exist in fantasy.
Yes, and that is precisely another point. Like, there's so many hidden stories that with a bit of research, you know, I feel like we would discover that, you know, like, queer people existed in ancient history in all cultures. Sometimes modernization sort of regressed that part a little bit and hit that part a little bit. So my view is, I don't know, my view is just that they existed, so we should write them. And in a fantasy world, when you're controlling so many things, you don't necessarily have to make it like the less savory parts of our world in that sense, when it comes to like, you know, queer people just trying to exist and trying to have rights. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're allowed to have more than one marginalized identity, in my opinion.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, because it's somehow baffling that, you know, sometimes people forget that Asians are disabled too, Asians are neurodivergent too, Asians are queer too, or, you know, any other BIPOC community has so many intersections and so many, you know, with so many marginalizations. Like, you know, we're just normal people who have, you know, stuff.
I want to talk about the amazing illustrations that you have that accompany your book, because it's something I wish more fantasy books would include, is just illustrations of, you know, key scenes or characters.
We just want a light novel, pretty much, with illustrations in between the prose.
I would love to write a light novel. Like, and I guess you're talking about the art that I commissioned, and then...
Oh, so you commissioned it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that was commissioned. And I don't know. I guess it's one... It comes back to me being a visual person. And I think I also want it to be... At the start, I just really wanted everybody to know that this is how the aesthetic looks like. You know, they're not elves. They're not like token high fantasy. This is, you know, a Chinese-inspired high fantasy. Yes, the dudes have long hair. Yes, they're wearing things that look like dresses, but they're not dresses. You know, just making sure. Because I didn't know how, if readers were that familiar with it. And like you said, you know, I wrote the book in 2016, 2017. I was on submission for 2018 and a lot of 2019. And before then, you know, like things like The Untamed wasn't on Netflix, you know. The number of people that were familiar with the aesthetics of Chinese dramas and wuxia shows were less, I assume. This was before Shang-Chi. This was before so many things, before like Disney's live action Mulan and so on. So I felt like art was an important way to communicate that this is how it looks like. You know, when you're reading it, you know, this is how you can imagine how they look like. And also, personally, because I love art, I just wanted to have, you know, art of my characters because it's really cool.
Yeah. I love how you were just like, this is how it's going to look. Screw your imagination. It's wrong. This is what it looks like. I really love the illustrations because it reminded me of like my childhood when I grew up like reading manga and manhwa, and like a lot of that aesthetic was very familiar to me. Yeah. And I really love the cover, the US cover of Jade Fire Gold, but I noticed that the UK version is vastly different. So my question is, like, do you have a favorite, and also what happened?
That's such a dangerous question. I actually don't have a favorite because I wasn't sure if the US cover came first. So I wasn't sure if the publisher would go with an illustrated cover with, you know, Asians on the cover, or like an object-based cover with like the sword, which plays a big role in the story, or like maybe some other motif, like Chinese motif or something, because... authors, like, contrary to popular belief, authors have very little say in the covers most of the time. So, I mean, they were kind enough to ask me to, like, you know, share some mood boards, my Pinterest and so on. So I showed them like a bunch of like ideas and aesthetics. Once again, yes, they have long sleeves and so on. And I was very, very fortunate that the main cover designer for Jade Fire Gold is Asian American, and she was familiar with the aesthetics, and she also was familiar with Asian illustrators. And I will say that, you know, the cover is a product of her genius. I only had some input at a later stage when most of it was done, and then we tweaked little bits. And she actually got a Singaporean illustrator, Zheng Guwei, to illustrate it, and I was just shocked and really, really happy. You know, like, hey, my fellow countrymen, and also an Asian illustrator. And when I saw it, I was really, really surprised and really, really happy because it was, I guess it's pretty different in a way.
Yeah, it definitely stands out when you put it on a bookshelf. Like, you can't help but look at it.
Yeah. I want to say usually it's the other way around where the American cover is kind of plain. And then I go to like Taiwan and see the international cover of these books, like on Kendara Blake's Three Dark Crowns. And it's like this really beautiful, like anime, like.
Yes.
We always complain. I was like, why do we not get like the cool anime, manga, manhwa illustrated covers? I mean, they look so pretty. More people would read it if the cover is pretty. Because we all judge books by covers.
Yes, we do. I hope we have more covers like that. Because I love manga. I love anime. I love just a different aesthetic from the kind of covers we tend to get in YA here. Although I think maybe things are changing. I'm seeing a lot of illustrated covers with...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And they're all really cool. As for the US, the UK cover, I...
Not saying that it's bad. I'm just saying, not to get you in trouble with your publisher.
I love it too, because in the sense that it's striking, the colors that they use, and I like how they stacked the title just like that, and drew a line in the middle, had the sword, and if you read the book, the cover kind of makes a little bit more sense and how they did the sword. And I think like I love both, because I feel like as an author, you're really lucky to get two different covers. You're really lucky to get a cover that you love, and then you're extra lucky to get two covers that are completely different, that showcase different aspects of, your book. And very strangely, I assume that the UK publisher knows exactly what they're doing, because they also distribute the book to Singapore, and all my Singaporean friends love the UK cover more.
Oh, okay. So they know what they're doing. They're the masters of marketing. They're trying to get a different demographic.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I mean, I assume maybe because, they're used to seeing, US like the manga like covers. So, the sort cover looks differently for them. Yeah.
I think we're just here in the States, we're just more hungry for something different, right?
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Well, we're winding down to the end of our time. So I'm going to ask you one more question, and it's more of a silly question. If you can do a crossover with any other fantasy for Jade Fire Gold, what would it be? It can be a book. It can be a TV show. It could be an anime. Go wild.
Crossover as in my characters?
Yeah, your characters.
World.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. This is fun. The first answer in my mind is Jujutsu Kaisen, anime and manga, but I'm actually writing a new project, which I feel like those characters might make more sense in that world. So, actually, I'm going to go with that. Kaisen. Just a bunch, because they have cursed magic, and then, the powers are kind of cool, and I feel like, it's sort of like might make sense in the xianxia way,
Yeah. I have one more question too, and this is because your book has kind of like an after credit scene at the end of it. So are you working on another book in this universe? Can you talk anything about that? Is it like under wraps right now?
Nothing is under wraps, because it is... As of this point, as of this recording, it is still a standalone. It was a one book deal, and that's all I have right now. I am working on something else, but it has nothing to do with Jade Fire Gold. Unfortunately, but who knows?
Yeah, you left the door open, and that's the important part.
Yes, just tiny little bit open. Yeah.
I guess I'll keep waiting then.
Yeah, just cling to the hope, Marvin.
Well, thank you so much, June, for joining us on Books and Bubble. It was such a fun chat. Good luck with the rest of you. And you're still in the midst of book launch, doing all your press. So, good good luck on all that. But we're super happy that you're able to carve out some time to stop by Books and Boba, and we wish you the best on your future endeavors.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was so fun.
Yeah. And that was June C.L. Tan, the author of Jadefire Gold, which is available at bookstores everywhere, including our Books and Boba online bookshop. If you go to booksandboba.com and check out our bookshop link, you can check out a ton of curated lists that Reader has put together, including every book that we've covered for this book club, as well as all the books of the author interviews that we've done. Reader, once again, thank you for maintaining our bookshop.org lists.
I will try to do my best to add more lists. I know some of those lists can be very long. I know some of those lists are like 40 or more books. And if you have any suggestions for what you want to read or see, just let us know on Twitter and I will try to curate a list for you.
Yeah. And as a reminder, every book you buy on our bookshop thus help support the podcast. So we really appreciate your support.
And for the month of November, we're almost at the end of 2021. Can you believe it? Wow. I can't. Time has no meaning. But our second to last book of 2021 is going to be On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. This book, you've probably heard of it. It's a bestseller, and we've heard wonderful things about it, so I'm excited to dive into it. It's also pretty short. It's only like 250 pages, so you'll get through it pretty quickly.
Yeah. If you've already finished the book, we'd love to hear your thoughts on our Goodreads forums. But otherwise, we're going to be discussing this book at the end of the month, so you have until then to read along with us. And yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. We'll see y'all next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.